Podcast. Welcome to the Almost Perfect Podcast, a celebration of fuck-ups, failures, and falling flat on your face. This is a podcast that believes you can learn from experience, but that experience doesn't have to be your own. Ha, I'm both perfect and I'm a functional fuck-up. Let's learn from somebody else's mistakes. And today we are learning from Angela de Klerk, or as I know her, Angela Japangela, because Angie used to be in a band called Japan and I, which if you are of my generation, if you're around my age, you almost definitely remember Japan and I. They did the things, man. They were in the magazines, they were on the radio, they were on TV, they played all the big music festivals in South Africa. And yeah, man, they had a really dope run. And were definitely one of my favorite bands. They used to come down to Durban fairly regularly. They definitely toured like a ton. And that's how I got to know them. That's how I got to know Angela and Dee Dee and Mandy. And the fourth unofficial member, I think, of Japan and I, Lil Bo. And we used to have some great fucking times together when they came down. So this was wonderful, man. Like, this was such a cool catch-up. Especially since Angela wasn't necessarily, you know, super keen to do the interview. I think she was keen. She was just a bit nervous. I guess we'd chat a little bit about it at the end. But yeah, man, she's one of my favorite vocalists. Just like straight up, like no qualifiers to that. Just one of my favorite vocalists. Absolutely love her voice. And it's been cool to see her career evolve over time. Because since Japan and I, she's been in a group called Rambling Bones, which is head up by Jay Bones from Fuzzy Gush. And also West of the Moon, which is a jazz duo that she's a part of. And we'll chat about it in the podcast, but it's, you know, one of the things I admire about Angie is, yeah, she's always worked on her craft. And over the years, like, she only got into, so West of the Moon is like a jazz duo. And she only got into jazz vocals fairly late in her career, like after like a decade of being in bands and that she decided, hey, I wanna level up a bit. I wanna try some different shit. I wanna see just what I can do with my voice. And that led to a lot of singing alone at home after getting some vocal lessons. But yeah, I'm telling you too much, I think. I'm telling you too much. But like I say, this is, yeah, really dope conversation. We also chat about Angela deciding to become a yacht stewardess in her 30s to try and supplement being a musician in South Africa. So we chat about what that experience is like and how she's trying to find a balance between making money and making music. Because it turns out those two things are mutually fucking exclusive, unfortunately, for a lot of people. And yeah, man, fuck, I don't even know where to go with that. I will try not to bring you all down. Because for the most part, it's a really fun chat. But yeah, I guess I need to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by you. Which means you can support it by going to patreon.com/almostperfect. You can also go to almostperfect.co.za, click on the merch tab and buy yourself a t-shirt, a sweater, or a mug. And yeah, if you just wanna donate some money, there's a little Zapper thing on the website too. You can just scan that. Send me 10, 20 bucks. And that goes a long, long, long way. Like, if everyone who listens to this podcast had to just swing a 10 or 20 here and there, I wouldn't have to consider going and working on the yachts as I'm staring down 40. Because, yeah, this week was my birthday. It was my 37th birthday on Wednesday. I'll chat to you properly about it at the end of the show in that. But I had a great day, man. It was, yeah, it was necessary in some ways, because it started out like just me being mopey and depressed and just like, ugh, life isn't where I want it to be. I hate my fucking birthday. I don't want any attention today. All this dumb shit. And then I had some amazing people make me feel really good. Most notably, my girlfriend, who took the day off work, and we went and had a lovely day. Like, we went and had breakfast on the beach. We went to the Durban Art Gallery. I took her to a dive bar in town that is fucking dope, man. We bought like two drafts for 65 rand. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Why are these other places selling me drafts for 45, 50, 60 rand when I can go to town and get the exact same fucking beer for like, what, like a third less at least? But yeah, we did that. at a sick fucking shawarma from Aladdin's. Aladdin's one of my favorite shawarma places in town. And I've been going there, and it was amazing to see the place like without like a long line. So I was like, let's quickly map a shawarma. And then yeah, we did comedy at Ace's Pizza, as we do every single Wednesday, which I hosted, and I had quite a fun time. So yeah, we'll chat a little bit more about that at the end. Other than that, I know there's probably some Joburgers listening to this, so come check us out at the Bioscope on the 30th of March. Once again, we'll tell you about the rest of that at the end. But now though, here it comes. It's the Almost Perfect Podcast with Angela DeClercq. So how are you living, Angela?
Hello, thank you for asking, Bob. I'm living very well, thank you. Just in Johannesburg at the moment, in between jobs. So I have been enjoying my third summer in a row.
Oh wow!
Yeah, it's a lot. I miss the seasons, but yes, I can't complain. I mean, it's kind of the best. So yeah.
Yeah, in some ways it looks like you've been living the dream, because in between jobs, you basically mean, you know, in between international tours, partially from your band, and then also, I guess we'll get into it just now, partially from working on yachts and stuff like that. But how was the last tour? Because I saw you were playing with the Shabs over in Europe.
Yes, exactly. I joined them for a tour in November. It just works out if I'm around and I can, then I do. So I feel very lucky in that regard. And yeah, it was incredible. We played shows in Czech Republic, Germany, and Austria this time around. And they were great. People are awesome that side and very supportive of small bands. And yeah, it's great.
And the folk punk kind of vibes.
Yes, very, very supportive. Like great communities. We get to play squats that side. And just see this very cool sort of leftist side of Germany and whatnot. And yeah, it's very interesting. There's so much history there in these spaces. So I feel super lucky that I get this insight into these sort of venues and like movements, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it does help expand your own political viewpoints, I guess, and also to see how things can actually work when it is like, you know, collective base and when it is squats and that. Because I know, you know, in South Africa, punk's always kind of had the veneer of middle classness almost to it, you know.
True. Sure.
Like, I know I got pretty disillusioned when I was young in the scene and that. And like, you know, I come from Umbilo and like grew up in a single parent home. And so like I always related to punk because I thought it was, you know, a bunch of, you know, lower class kids, because that's kind of how it started, you know, busy just talking about how shit the world was. And then I remember, I'm not going to mention the band or whatever, but I remember going back to the one guy's place from like a pretty popular Durban punk band, and it was like a 3-story house. And I was just like, fuck.
It's not as relatable all of a sudden.
Yeah, got pretty disillusioned with that. It's also kind of interesting, I guess, with the Germany's thing with their current politics, but that was you were there just a bit before everything that's been happening in Gaza and Israel, yeah.
Not necessarily. So that's actually really interesting to bring up, because I was, you know, it's quite interesting coming from South Africa. You know, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about fascism and like, you know, I don't know. But when you go there, there's just stickers all over the bathroom, Antifa, da da da. It's like you just see it all over the place. And it's like sort of on your mind. So I was just like asking, you know, these local Germans, you know, what is the vibe here? Like, why is it, are you still like feel like you're on the front lines fighting fascism? I do struggle with that word. And yeah, like from what it sounds like, you know, unfortunately, it is still something that pops up, you know, even in these small towns, there'll be these sort of just Nazi-esque type people who will, you know, sort of attack a punk or, sort of have very like, yeah, it's a strong sort of movement there still. I think it's still small, but it's still there. And I was quite shocked because, you know, you just think of Germany like, oh, it's probably this
progressive,
idyllic place that you want to move to get a job, you know, so many people do. Yeah. And then you find out actually there's all this sort of hateful movement still happening. And then, So then we were chatting to a beautiful friend of ours, of the Shabs, who had been our tour manager in the tour that got cancelled by COVID. So this is 2020. But anyway, she, I won't mention names, just, you know, and she was, we were talking about the whole situation in Gaza and whatnot, and how, yeah, just how incredibly awkward it is now to support Gazians, you know, as a German, because so many people see it as, of course, straight to anti-Semitic, and yeah, the government's just cracking down on that side on anti-Semitism, and they've sort of lost the plot a little bit, you know, like, yeah. So, and being like pro-genocide again, whoopsie. So it's just crazy because she's had like actual, you know, she's had people cancel work on her before just because, she was pro-Palestine. And they didn't, yeah. So it's just crazy. So it's very real there, you know?
Yeah. I've been seeing a lot of stuff about that, like, you know, especially with artists and stuff, you know, pro-Palestinian artists in Europe or in some European countries, like, yeah, being denied and like not getting visas and having stuff canceled. And it's so crazy because, like, for the rest of the world who's getting, I guess, a different media to what some of the West is getting, we see it completely fucking differently. But, you know, if your news sources and your governments and everyone's telling you, like, this is the wrong thing, like, it gets fucking, like, it's hard to, like, for people on the ground, I guess, in those kind of spaces to really know what's happening.
Exactly, yeah. No, I think so.
Yeah. Anyway, we're not going to solve any of those crises with this chat, I don't think.
Thank goodness. I was really sweating there for a second.
Although, actually, like, this does, like, I was going to bring this up a little bit later, but for this interview, I've actually got one of the first interviews you guys ever did with SL Magazine when you were still 18.
Wait, you guys, obviously meaning Japan and I, yeah. Wow.
Yes. Japan. Wow. And I, yes. Funnily enough, it was in the sex issue.
Oh, funny.
That's because you guys, like, as a band, were one of the few that, like, didn't, like, use that. Well, not one of the few, but, you know, you didn't use that at all. So I found that kind of ironic.
Use what? You mean the fact that it was the sex edition?
No, well, just sex in general. Like, you know, like, a lot of time women have to, you know, sell the whole sex side of things to actually get ahead or to be noticed and stuff like that. And always kind of like found it cool that you guys were just fun and cute and like offered a different side of things.
Oh, I'm glad that came across. Cause yeah, that was definitely never our kind of, yeah, we were always sort of trying to just be not taking it too seriously and being fun was generally the Japan and I message. I'm glad that came across.
Okay, but the thing I did want to bring up, and this isn't like a gotcha because we can like discuss it, but one of the funny things I found in it was you saying that we're not feminists, and I hate when people who think it's cool to hate hate people who think it's cool to hate. That was one of the little quotes that they had from you then, but this was when you were 18.
We're
so
not,
I assume,
feminist.
That's changed quite a bit. Yeah.
we don't. So we must have thought that feminism was sort of hateful, I suppose, if I had to analyze.
Yeah, because that is like also what the media kind of representation of feminism back in the day and still to some degree these days is. It's that it's, you know, this curmudgeonly, you know, no fun, no, I don't know. Like it just has always kind of had some of a negative like connotation to it. So I'm sure when you're younger, you just wanted to be like, we're not like those girls.
That's so fascinating. Yeah, I mean, this is interesting to you. Definitely feminist now. That's changed. Yeah. and I agree. I must have been, yeah, like this horrible connotation that it was just these like hairy, angry women just being like, ah, we're like, oh, we're not them. We love everyone. But no, I am now a hairy, ugly feminist, and proud of it. But yeah, I think it was just, we were young maybe. But it's true. I do speak to people about sort of feminist, and I think so many people are feminists without realizing it because of that horrible connotation, yeah. You know, and you're just like, well, do you want women to get paid the same for the same job? Yes. I'm like, okay, well then you're basically a feminist, I think.
Exactly.
I think that's
always the thing. It's like, how can you be anti-feminism? All it is just saying like everyone should be equal. It's basic. Like it's just fundamental. But exactly. Yeah. But yeah, what's your political, you know, what do you credit to your political learnings and stuff? I'm assuming being in the punk scene to some degree must have set you on the path.
You know, I'll be honest and quickly give myself a little disclaimer here. Like, I'm not really very political in any real sense. I think I do my best. I think I don't ever research or know enough about any topic to feel comfortable saying, well, this is what I believe and this is what I kind of just go on intuition and be like, well, that feels right. And, you know, so I'm not a very staunch sort of politically inclined person, and I'm not always very clued up on the sort of, goings on. I have a generally good idea, I think, of what's happening and a generally good idea of where I stand. Of course, that will change, you know, when you learn more things. But so, yeah, I guess I'm pretty, I don't know, I'm a very sort of open-minded, free spirit. So that's my politics.
Well, I guess what I was just trying to get at is like, yeah, how was, you know, how did the punk scene like help you grow up, I guess?
That's a good question. Well, it's interesting because, you know, we, like you said, it was a very sort of middle class situation, and we are all very white privileged sort of suburban kids, you know, in that scene.
Yeah, there's a lot of cosplaying.
Yeah, so I think, but it still means something to, you can still, you know, you pull your own meaning out of that scene. You know, for us, it was like the sense of community and belonging and sort of questioning the government. And, you know, you grow, you know, you're young, so you're like, fuck authority. And, you know, of course, that has more meaning when you, let's say, live in Palestine right now, or you lived in, you know, the original sort of movement in the UK or whatever, that, you know, of course, and as like, again, white privileged South Africans, it's not as easy to point to, you know, an obvious thing. Like, but I guess, it was just like finding this music scene that felt like ours, and it was so niche and it was so small. So it just felt like, yeah, something's amazing that we belong to, you know, and that's where we've made all our friends over the years. And, so I don't know. And I think it just sort of teaches you, yeah, just to sort of question things and do your own research and sort of get educated. I would say it would be the overall, sort of growing up in that industry, as, you know, and also we like to go out and drink and have fun. And it was just nice to find like-minded people. And I mean, that's my whole world was from the music scene growing up. Like, it's everyone I know now still is from that. So, you know, it sort of shapes everything, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the same for me. I still, yeah, like from back in the day, most of those people are still, a lot of them have been on this podcast as well, you know? And it was very foundational. And like for me, yeah, it's just that community aspect of things, regardless of, you know, class and that, because also, you know, it did cross class barriers and to some degree race barriers, but not anywhere near enough back in the day. But yeah. I don't know, I've seen that's changed a little bit. But it was, I think, it was a cool space for people who, yeah, even if you are white and middle class, still see things as being whack, you know, still seeing like the status quo as being a bit fucked up and going like, well, this sucks. And for myself, I know, like, you know, I first heard about Noam Chomsky from NoFX. So that's been since then quite foundational. And like, you know, I've learned so much more. Like, obviously, Noam Chomsky's had a way bigger impact on my life since then, you know, NoFX did. But I always do credit to like a lot of those like Anti-Flag and NoFX and like Rage Against the Machine and all of that, with like instilling just that fuck you attitude in me that's kind of been pervasive.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. You know, and it was interesting because I actually encountered Noam Chomsky because I studied linguistics. So he was a big deal in that as well. So it was like, yeah, what a great guy.
That's fucking cool. Like both those things. I actually didn't know you studied linguistics.
I know. Crazy. It's a long time ago. Don't test me on anything.
I guess there's no real jobs in that though.
What exactly? Well, I think if I stuck with it, you could probably, it's like training AI back in the day.
Oh, God.
Sort of the thing to speak, and look how far they've come. Yeah? In 15 years, it was just this like training computers to understand English. And now it's like, yeah, they're, yeah, it's way more advanced now. But I think that is that and forensics, which is would have been interesting. But
what? Damn.
Yeah, I think you can, because it's sort of like coding for, yeah, anyway. So I think that could have been a direction, but I was doing the whole other music thing.
whole music thing. And when did you realize you can sing? Because like, you've been one of my favorite vocalists, like literally since the beginning, and you only got better as you got older. So how did you know like, I fucking love your voice.
But thank you.
I imagine you've taken a bit of a journey with that.
I have. I mean, I think I didn't, I didn't really know I could sing. I remember, you know, our friend Lauren. I remember once we did karaoke when
Little Bo, shout out.
We were doing karaoke once. We were teenagers. And then I think we did some sort of No Doubts, or I don't know, I'm Just a Girl sort of.
Nice.
I don't know what it was, but I remember I was just belting it out. And she was like, oh, you can actually sing. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe I can. I don't know. You know, it never really occurred to me. I think, you know, it just sort of happened. And then, of course, since then, I've put in a lot of work. Not so much in the Japan Lie days. So it's really hard for me to listen to those recordings. But
really?
I think
you fucking killed it for how old you were at the time, especially, and like how inexperienced. Like, that was the thing. Like, I mean, obviously, everything about the band, like, you know, I felt worked. But like, yeah, I was just like, fuck, that's some range right there.
That's cool, man. That's nice to hear. I mean, yeah, I think it was raw, you know, and that worked.
Yes.
Japan and I was very much not a non, it was just like,
we just, that was the appeal.
I think so, because we weren't very educated musicians. Well, Mandy had some. I certainly wasn't. And so I think it was more like warming up. Like, I would destroy my voice after every show, you know, and, you know, we, back in the day, you'd gig quite a bit, and then I would just not have a voice. So I think eventually I got help for that, just like simple warm-ups, game changer.
Who did you get help from?
Oh, it was a family friend. She does like sort of public speaking, and she's like, you know, girl, you need some help. Like, so she gave me really simple stuff way back when, because it really is simple. You know, nowadays you just like YouTube vocal warm-ups, but back then you just don't think about it. I don't know. I think I was still on sort of ADSL internet. You know what I mean? Like,
I remember when the Zen of Screaming came out, like it was a DVD, that thing got copied and passed around like the whole of the Durban scene.
That was a hit. That went around. Sure, I think that was great. But yeah, it's true, because there weren't many other resources at that time. You know, now you think how easy it is, but I think this is pre-YouTube.
early, YouTube wasn't what it was now. Basically.
Yes, you're not going to get some friendly Canadian, you know, teaching you anything. Like
you can be the best you can be. You just got to breathe. And
I got help from that lady, and that really helped a lot. And then I started doing more ambitious things many years later. I was learning jazz vocals, and that was very humbling. And I was like, wow, I really know nothing about anything, as that can happen to you when you embark on a jazz journey.
And where'd you learn that?
Well, it was a mixture of, I went to some vocal lessons with this lovely lady and a few different people over the years. And that was really helpful. But then with jazz, it was sort of self at home, just, trying my best. Well, what the best was that I eventually teamed up with my friend Nick Rumpal to, you know, we have a little duo now. So the best way to learn jazz is to, you know, play or anything, to learn anything, you just have to do it. So then we started jamming, and then I had to try and get good enough very quickly to start playing live, because that's sort of what I like to do mainly. So I had to get good real quick. I had some help along from different people along the way, of course, Nick as well. And these vocal teachers, but at the end of the day, you're just sitting in front of a piano or whatever, just like painfully trying to sort of understand these really bizarre harmonies that your ear's not used to hearing if you're not brought up on jazz or anything like that. So that was a huge learning curve, which is cool. It was good to challenge myself so much later on in my singing career.
Well, when was that?
Goodness, a few years ago. I must have been, you know, I'm not very good at keeping track.
Fair enough, same.
It must be about 4, I don't know.
Well, so it is like really late in your career, because that's like 10 years in at least.
Yeah, because, you know, with Japan and I and Rambling Bones, it's always been sort of that raw sort of sound, well, at least for me. I won't say that.
You still do a lot with it, but yeah, I get you.
Like, but to actually hone something, and, you know, like jazz is good for that, because you really have to, you know, do the work. You can't just rely on, like, you know, a little couple warm-ups and some natural talent. You know, it makes you sort of be more disciplined, which I think is really good in any industry.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that the youth these days might not necessarily be as aware of, or like, because of, you know, the instant gratification of the internet, like people will post themselves like learning to do stuff, which is cute and it's fun, but at the same time, it's like you can do a lot more and get a lot better at stuff if you actually just sit at home and work on the thing without any intention of anyone ever knowing that you're doing it. But
that's true. Yeah.
But yeah, we're just living in a very different age, which I guess I could talk to you a little bit about how you're finding the social media age. Because, like, yeah, from Japan in our days, you guys were in the media. You know, you were in Blunt Magazine, you were in SL TV, you know, you were on radio and everything like that. And now as a musician, your main ways of being heard are Spotify or Instagram.
Yeah, it's an interesting journey to have experienced both, I guess. I can't say I've loved social media at all I was one of the last people to get on Facebook. And then it was like, okay, this is useful tool to advertise shows. And then, of course, they brought in the algorithm, and then you were paying for that same reach. You'd already earned your 2,000 followers. A very modest 2,000. And like, now I have to pay to reach those 2,000, you know. So I just got, I mean, of course you have to do it. You sort of feel like you have to do it. But I didn't go in happily like, I love this new technology. It's always been annoying. It's been like something I have to do. I think we would go to shows and like put out flyers on people's cars, you know, and I would still actually prefer doing that, I think, than having to, you know, make a cool Instagram and Instagram post where you have to think of something fun and cool to say, you know. But it's, I don't know, for me, it's that's not been my strong point. Let me put it that way. It's not my strong point working on those like platforms. None of us have been really good at that. Actually, if I think about all the bands I've been in, none of us are great at that, except the Shabs. Shout out to them, those guys.
Yeah, they know how to do that shit well.
Yes, they do it well and they're consistent. So yeah, it is quite strange. I mean, you obviously don't think of it about it when it's happening, because you just live in life as things happen slowly. And then, 10 years in and you, I don't know. For me, just seeing how things on Spotify, I mean, it's not good. Yeah. It doesn't support artists at all. You know, when I see when actual artists who are getting thousands and thousands of views still can't make money off of Spotify or something like that, it's super tragic. So, but having now toured with the Shabs in Germany, and let's say where they're obviously more affluent there, and the support there on the merch and buying vinyls and everything is incredible. So of course that will always be the sort of the best thing. Play live, sell your music. I think that will always be the best sort of way to do it. And it, like I said, there just works, because even though you're playing in some tiny pub to a very tiny group of people, all of those people support you, you know, and it's amazing because they can. So obviously South Africa is different, and we've all, you know, it's way harder. Even me, I don't have the actual CDs of most of the bands I've loved in this country, you know, because I was also pretty broke most of my 20s.
And so that's why you become a music reviewer. You get them for free. that was my plan.
Exactly.
That's literally why I've still got your guys' CD, although I found that at Cash Crusaders a few years back.
No way. Well, I'm sure you have somewhere in my mother's garage. You know, let's just hand those out if anyone's interested.
I'm sure some people would love that for real.
I got free CDs for everybody.
It was interesting though, because like I was checking through, you know, YouTube and stuff, and like there's not a lot. Other people have posted your music videos and stuff on there, and just it was interesting seeing the comments and stuff like that, and people just being like, "Oh, this takes me back. And like, what was that like to be a part of a band that like people actually like liked and sang along to and cared about and, you know, like showed up for?
It's very special. I feel very lucky, you know, and, you know, I'm still besties with Mandy and Didi, of course, from Japan, and I. And it's amazing when someone, you know, and they're usually obviously older because we all are older. There's like a sort of certain cutoff where people are like, who? What band? It's awesome when someone comes up and like says something or yeah, an old friend who randomly heard it or came up on a playlist or something. And they're like, oh, this is so rad to hear it. Of course, that's so special. It was like the best time of our lives. You know, we had so much fun. And like I said earlier, we made all our friends. So the fact that it takes people back and like hits a certain nostalgic points and that's good vibes. You know, that's the best you can hear.
Like living through it, like, was it any like pressure at all or anything like that?
I mean, no. I mean, I think being young, there were certain like decisions we had to make along the way that now I look back and sort of chuckle at because we were like, I'm not going to sell out and all that, you know, like, and, you know, just silly sort of things that we did. You know, it's just sad when you look back about all the magazines and MK and all these sort of platforms that existed then that did so much for us, which was amazing, that don't exist anymore completely. So it's quite strange to think back at that time. You know, we were so lucky to be on TV, you know, and to do all this, you know, all these interviews on all these different platforms. No real pressure. I think just pressure on yourself. Like I wanted to do better, do more. I think to tour more, to try to overseas. I mean, we didn't manage to play on the, what do they call it? A Primavera. It's a stage specifically for smaller bands around the world. I can't remember. So we did that and that was epic.
So that's a cool thing. It took you overseas and everything. Like, so that was your first experience. Like, and, but also like, what was it like touring, you know, with three girls, like, you know, young woman touring the country? Like, what was that experience and overseas?
Oh no, that was the best. I mean, we had, you know, we had the best time, man. Yeah, we got to go everywhere in the country. Everyone was really lovely to us. I can't say there was a huge amount of sexism that we noticed. I think the only thing that bothered me back in the day was they'd call us a group. Some people would call us a group instead of a band. And I was like, girl group.
Girl
and
you're group.
Like, good band, man. Look at that instrument. But other than that, I mean, everybody, you know, it's just our friend. It's just the scene, you know, everyone was so rad and chilled. And yeah, of course, going to Spain, it was my second time going overseas ever. And it's the best. I mean, going with your best friends to Primavera, it's like, it was great. And so professional over there, just like treated us like we were a big deal, even though we're, you know, playing on the small stage. And da, da, da. It was so professional and so amazing.
I mean, I guess that's a big difference to South Africa to some degree. I mean, sure, everyone, like, you know, is nice to you guys, but, like, yeah, there's no showers.
I mean, yeah, South Africa. I mean, South Africa is its own special place where you have a different set of expectations.
But, yeah, you guys never really seem to mind, you know, getting stuck in the mud, basically.
No, yes. We learned that first splashy fin about the mud. And we did literally get stuck in that mud, but never again. Never again.
You learned to wear gumboots.
Exactly. Exactly. Metaphor for life. Or just literally splashy fin.
So how did you, meet Jay Bones? Because Rambling Bones is also a big part of your musical career.
Yes. So Jay, so Japan and I had done a few tours. Well, obviously we're just mega fans of Fuzzy-ish, since we were children. And then Japan and I, we did a tour with, we did a tour with them and just over the years got to know them. And then out of the blue, I think I could be wrong. It's a long time ago. My memory is terrible. Jay asked if I wanted to sing a duet with him. And that is, wow, I'm pulling blanks. That's so bad. No, that's not
good. A long time ago.
No, but it's like the main song. Sorry.
Oh, yes. I know which song you're talking about. I also can't remember the name, but it's iconic.
That's terrible. Baby Shoes. Jeez. Wow.
Yes.
Sorry. I'm just having stage fright. Baby Shoes. So he asked me to come sing on that. And I was so nervous because it's Jay from Fuzzy-ish. And I'm such a fan. And I was so intimidated. So anyway, we did that. And then I would come and sing that song live with them. And then I can't remember sort of how it evolved. I know at some point I was playing bass and then not very good bass.
That's not your particular instrument, is it?
No, but I mean, you get like, yeah, exactly. So
there's transferable skills.
I did. Yeah, there is some, but I did my best, but I won't claim to be any sort of amazing bassist. And then just sort of became a permanent member over the years, and sort of more percussion and backup vocals, and obviously started singing more with Jay, and just sort of evolved into being a permanent member, just absorbed myself into the band. It was great though, and it's been great.
And what did you learn from working with Jay and the rest of, you know, the guys? Because obviously they had a lot of fucking experience.
Yes, for sure. What did I learn? Jeez. It's hard to think of, you know, you just do things that I always reflect on. I don't know. I think Jay's just an incredible songwriter and an awesome human to be around, just an all-round amazing human being, as well as Eric and Leighton. And I know the band sort of has members that sort of come and go.
Yourself included.
Myself now included. But yeah, I think just, I don't know, Jay's just a great songwriter. And in general, like the professionalism and, you know, actually, no, now that I've thought about it, I think what I love, my favorite thing that I love about Jay is that he doesn't take anything too seriously, you know, but he's still professional and he's an amazing musician, but like everything is just like playtime and having a good time and just not taking yourself very seriously. So I think that was great coming from Japan and I as well to Rambling. It's not like the serious band where people get upset about band practice and there's drama.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's like a schedule and, you know, like
the social media schedule as well.
Exactly. It's like the complete opposite. It's like, if you're not having fun, then like, please don't be here. You know, this is all for a good time. You know, everyone else has their 9-to-5 jobs and that's serious sort of, that's a time to be serious. But here it's just to have, just for the love of music, basically.
That's dope that there is that separation. I think that's something that Joburg bands did fairly well, was the whole day job thing, and often in music as well, which allowed the bands to actually have a bit more freedom and be less dickheadish, I guess. Because if you don't, like, if it's not, everything's not just riding on like the band making it, you can have a lot more fun.
I know, but it's just such a pity because I went through a little bit of that with Japan and I, because I was a little bit more keen on trying to push more. So I was the dickhead of Japan and I, you know, I was the one pushing and like making, doing everything towards the end, just because I think I was more keen to like have it go further. The girls were in different spaces and stuff, so you can't force it exactly. So I feel like someone like Jay is this very wise man who knows, you know, so it's like,
he knows the balance.
He knows the balance. And it's true. Like, I mean, it's sad. Of course, I would absolutely do everything to only do music and make money from that. Like, of course. But I've also sort of just been flexible and I just get it when and where I can. And that's also why now I'm the slaves on the super yachts, you know, because you do have to make money eventually.
We're going to get into, this was literally what I was starting to think about. So I was like, I assume, yeah, that's why you went and worked on the yachts, because that was something our friend Pascal did for a few years to pay for his pilot's license. And he made like a lot of fucking money doing a lot of shit work. So was that why you were inspired? You're like, I can go work for 6 months, like make a lot of money, come back and do what I love.
Exactly. I'm trying to figure out that sort of balance. It's a bit hard being away and then coming back and then trying to figure out how to do the music thing, because, you know, stuff changes and I feel like a bit out the loop when I come back. But yes, no, look, eventually a lot of different things happen in life. But it all boils down to, okay, eventually I had to be like, okay, I actually need money. I'm in my 30s now. I need to make my, everyone else has got money. Like, I should probably get some.
I feel this way and I'm like turning 37. So I've thought about it so many times, but I always have like other stuff tying me down. But there's always been a part of me that's like, yeah, just go work on the ships for a while.
just, you know, it's not easy work and it's not easy to get work.
You got to walk the docks and stuff.
It's a quite something, you know, in your 30s, you know, I'm hanging out with these something year olds.
That was also something I was thinking about. That must have been a big step for you though, because like there's obviously you know, I don't know if there's a stigma or whatever, but it's, yeah, it is a thing that's usually done by younger people.
Exactly. No one said it to my face, but I think I'm pretty intuitive that I know that it's a little bit harder for me as a stewardess because the sexism and that whole industry is miles behind, you know, sort of what I'm used to here in Joburg. You know, it's very sexist. And, you know, of course they want young hot stewardess ladies. So even as a man wanting to be a stewardess, it's sexist and, you know, and vice versa. Of course, it's changed a lot. I think it must have been way worse. So I'm sure it's evolving. Again, just lagging behind the rest of the sort of creative world. So I do think I struggle to get a job just because some young chief stewardess doesn't want to hire someone in their 30s to boss around. But you know, I eventually got a job. And then once you have experience, it gets easier.
Cause yeah, you set up the network and stuff and you have, like, I know the Yachties are a whole culture of their own.
It's networking, baby. Like everything is like, you have to literally.
So that take you back to the early days of being in a band?
I mean, sure. I guess the drinking level is about the same. A little bit harder in the south of France, a little bit more pricier than 12 rand courts at London Calling. But yeah, the ethos is the same. I mean, no, it's like worlds apart, actually. There's nothing similar at all that I could compare the yachting industry to. It's been a real adventure for me in a lot of different ways. Just, it was nice to get out of Joburg, see the, you know, just, I was doing a lot of work behind a computer. So it was nice to get away from that sort of thing. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It was just nice for me personally. I needed a break. So there's a lot of perks, but it's a very strange and interesting and new industry for me. Like, it was very eye-opening how the rest of the world functions when you've sort of been sheltered by this creative world in Joburg where all your friends are like-minded and have sort of ideas on life. And then you get thrown into yachting and there's a lot of ex-military sort of Navy captains. It's just a little bit more old school. And
the youths are all like just buying fucking... Like, they're just spending their money on watches and, like, you know, expensive shit.
Yeah, just meeting, like, very different types of South Africans. And I'm like, wow, I live in a bubble in Johannesburg. bless them all that I have met. no hate. Just different. Just very different. Which is exciting in your 30s to do something, like, completely wildly different. And then sort of impress yourself that you managed to survive it, you know, like, when you challenge yourself, because it is challenging. It's really hard work. You're physically demanding. Yeah. And so the whole sort of sharing a cabin and sharing a small space with people for a very long time with not a lot of days off in between, or if you're lucky, there is. But
and there's long hours, and often the guys who own the yachts are also often dickheads.
They can be. I've been lucky, but yes, I've heard horror stories of dickheadery happening and crew. Honestly, the crew will, you can deal with shitty guests.
Because they leave.
Yes. Or just if your crew is tight, you know, if you have the backbone is like solid and you trust each other, you know, then it's bearable. But if the crew is bad, then it's unbearable in every sense. Like, yeah, it can be quite awful. If you have someone giving you a hard time on the boat. And I worry because I meet a lot of these young, you stay in a crew house when you start. You have to go to Antibes, let's say, south of France. You stay in a crew house and you try and look for a job. You kind of have to be there, right? They're not going to pay for you to come out from South Africa. So, and most of these are kids, like sometimes under 20 years old. And, you know, some of the stories, you know, of these young girls on these boats with these creepy, old freaking engineers and captains who, you know, just sexually harass, like this, it's just so, you know, it's so prevalent still.
Yeah. And there's no HR departments.
Exactly. But I think it's changed a lot. I think, you know, 20 years ago, it must've been a free for all, but now I have a feeling with just the whole world changing and women feeling more empowered or safe to speak up that I think it's definitely better, but it's very concerning, you know, when you think about these young women. And these old men just take advantage. And I'm not saying, you know, I'm sure that could happen to young men as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it is a very strange industry. And but you make good friends. And I do think these like young women, like the one lady from the crew house, she sort of spoke up and we were all like, just get out. So it's sort of like it has an inbuilt support system as well.
Nice. Well, yeah, that's great to hear. Cause yeah, I mean, I've also heard some horror stories on that and also heard some like funny stories. So any celebrity like guests and stuff?
I mean, I not
that
really.
That you're allowed to talk about it? Okay,
no. I know you do sign all these things, but to be honest, I had they like somewhat, but nothing really interesting. It was like I said, I've been lucky. I've had they've been like Scandinavian owned, very chilled family vibes, so I can't complain. I've had it very easy.
Now, do you take the kids out on the jet ski and stuff like that?
Oh, the deckhands get to do that. I'm a stewardess. Oh,
okay. You're not there yet. Okay. Different.
I'm slaving away. Yes. but yeah, I've been lucky at least. Because yeah, just hear awful stories about prostitutes and jazz and all this crazy stuff that you have to deal with and be discreet about. And I'm sure, yeah, and certain cultures are like, you know, very awful towards women. So like I said, I've been lucky. The Scandinavians are very sort of down to earth. Normal yes. millionaires.
They're all used to it, you know, like
old money.
Old money, yeah. The only story like I've heard that like stuck with me was one of my friends was on the yacht and Beyonce and Jay-Z were on the yacht. And apparently Jay-Z works out to his own music. Apparently.
I know this story, and I think it's hilariously embarrassing to know that about oneself. I mean, about them. What a ridiculous, yeah. I don't have any fun stories like that, but you know, it's still early days. If I make it for longer than one more season.
Thought about working out to your own songs?
Oh, God, no. I can barely listen to him. Not because I have any hate. It's just I think anyone you listen to yourself, you're like, oh, cringe.
Trust me, editing these so things is a fucking nightmare.
Exactly. And I probably will never. I'm never gonna listen to this either again.
I assume most people like don't. You know when yes. they've been interviewed, especially for this long and that, because it is just like, oh fuck, I said that. Ah. Oh. Could have answered that better. Yeah, no, I trust me, I get that as well. Like when I'm editing, I'm just like, fuck, I could have asked a better question there. Like I interviewed Spook Matamba recently and like I felt like I was just over prepared and had too much that I wanted to talk to him about that like I wasn't necessarily listening properly, you know, and listening yeah. back I was just like, fuck, wasted opportunity.
Well, it's a double-edged sword, if that's the right analogy, like where you as an artist, as a podcast man, you have to sort of listen to learn, right? Because that's a good insight. Yep. Like, oh, you weren't listening to him. You could have asked better questions. You know, same with music, of course, on a live show or, oh, God forbid, a live show, but or a recording, you know. You're like, yeah, I really hate that guitar tone or sheesh, I really do those vocals better. So yeah, it's just sort of you gotta listen a little and then but you don't want to like get lost in that and just go into a spiral of self-hatred. You gotta know when to cap it, like where it's not productive anymore, I suppose.
The thing with live music though is like you don't really have the option, at least when you're doing it, to really hate yourself too much, because if you fuck up, you make a mistake, or you don't like the way you've sung something, you immediately have to carry on. So it's almost like that's at least like in some ways, I mean, I know that almost with comedy as well. It's like, hey man, I've got to fix this now and carry on. Like there's nothing I can fucking do about it. But the recorded stuff is where things get like, yeah, a little more tricky. Like even watching like comedy sets back, it's the worst. Cause you're like, I thought they laughed harder at that when I was on stage.
Oh, I don't even want to imagine life as a comedian. Like, yeah, that sounds like levels of excruciating trauma. No, I mean, it's just I respect you guys. It's a very courageous thing to do because you are alone and you know, there's nothing to hide behind. You know, we make these songs and then, you know, you sort of, that's it. But there you are, just all alone. So, respect.
Did you ever watch Marvelous Miss Maisel?
I did. I loved that show.
There's a scene with the guy who plays Lenny Bruce, well, with Lenny Bruce on the show, where he sings that song All Alone and like basically talking about like yeah, like losing love and whatever for the, his career. And it was just like, fuck.
You're having a moment there.
Yeah, it was a bit too relatable. And yeah. I mean, I guess I can like talk a little bit like what's dating like as a musician? Because I know that's something that not everyone, especially for you who tours like with also now you're traveling and stuff, and then also with the music and just having all these other people in your life and that, you know, how's that been? Are there people who understand or has it been a bit of a struggle?
No, I think most of the time I've just been single. That makes it really simple. No, I've had so many lovely boyfriends along the way, and no, most of them have been only supportive and amazing. Like, I don't think I toured enough with over the years for it to become, you know, I wish I had that problem. Like, oh, I was always on tour and it really put strain on this relationship. But no, not at all. I mean, yeah, just supportive.
No jealousy
people.
Vibes about, you know, your fame.
Of course. Okay. I mean, maybe back in the day when we were young and they were young and dumb, I'm not going to hold that against them. I'm sure they're all old and, you know, different now. You know, you're young. Of course, you're going to get jealous and stuff. But no, not. I mean, maybe I'm forgetting. Maybe I'm just like, ah, it's all good.
Repress the trauma. Repress the trauma.
Okay, you're right. Actually, it's starting to come back to me now. But I'm certainly not going to get into that now.
No, we don't have to.
But I mean, sure, some along the way. But that's.
I just imagine that being a bit tricky because I remember, like mostly with you know the guy bands and stuff, the girlfriends. You know, there was always some placating that had to be done to some degree because, like, you know, you have all the girls coming up after the show and, like, yeah, you don't know what happens when bands go on tour and things like that, you know?
Exactly. And no partners allowed on tour because we've had when they are allowed and then one of the couples are fighting and it's drama and it totally ruins the vibe because touring is the best. So, yeah, no partners allowed. That's a rule that should be adhered to. I think for all times, but yes, we certainly had sort of that. I mean, we didn't have sort of, we weren't, you know, that famous that people were, you know.
Yeah, but after shows, people would come up to you.
Yes, of course. And I think I mostly just, yeah, had, I can think of a few incidences, sure. But for the most part, it was pretty okay. So cheers to the exes for that, I suppose. not all of them. Just most of them.
Just most of them. Hey, that's a good ratio, I think, you know?
Exactly.
Like when I hear some people talk about the exes and then I'm like, but you made that choice.
That was... Yeah, exactly. Actually, this all comes down to my excellent choice of men, yes.
There you go. That's what I'm saying. Like, personally, I look back on all my exes. I'm like, yeah, they're all rad as fuck. Like, you know, like, I don't really have any issues with them. I'm like, they were right to call it when they did, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I'd have no hate, no animosity to any of my previous lovers.
Well, fair enough. Okay, I think we're going to head on out. And so I will ask you the question I ask everyone on this podcast. And that is, what is a big mistake that you've learned an important lesson from?
Oh, geez. just one?
Damn. I mean, we've still got some time. Like, how long do you have?
Prepared. Let me just get my answers for this. All my mistakes written down. Just
get out your diary.
I think it wasn't so much a mistake. It's more just there was a very tough period, in sort of starting late 20s, ending early 30s, where I was sort of really stuck, like really suffering from some mental issues, I suppose. Sure. So, and it just was such an unfruitful, uncreative, unproductive time of my life. So, wait, what was the question?
What's a big mistake you've learned an important lesson from?
Okay, we're learning lessons. So I was like, was it a regret or, okay. I guess the lesson there was, well, you know, I had to go through it, I guess. And then I eventually sought help through various methods and I'm doing so much better now. And feeling so much more, yeah, like just whole again. So I guess the lesson would be, if you're really struggling with some sort of, you're feeling really stuck and you've been there for a really, really long time, like, get help. It's okay. Because it took me a long time to figure that out. And I wish it had just been a shorter time, because I would have, just had more years to enjoy. But at the same time, fuck it. You learn so much. I learned so much, and I have more empathy for people who come across as awful people, and then you sort of understand that they're probably just being the worst to themselves. So, and you learn from all of that. So,
no, I totally get that. Is your therapist going to be proud of you for finally saying yes to coming on this podcast? Because I know it's been like a thing for you, where you've been like, oh, I don't know. What am I going to say? Like, I don't know if I should do it.
I know. Because I've not been interviewed or alone before, I've only ever done it with the band. And
oh, what? Really?
Security blanket in that. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not some sort of famous person alone.
Yeah, I get it. I get you've also always kind of made music with other people, so that does make sense.
Yes. I wish I was a solo artist. That is something I still wish to achieve.
Yeah, so why not?
I've just not been a strong enough guitarist, but there's other ways that I'm working on. So one day, because I remember when you asked originally, I was like, I want something to promote. Like, yeah. And now I've done this amazing thing, ta-da.
Now we can get you back once you release your debut.
But one day there will be, I hope to, because that will feel like a huge tick for me to have done something sort of alone and, released it into the world. So I hope to still do that. And I think, that's all I have to say about that.
Cool. Well, I mean, I'm obviously looking forward to that, because I think I've mentioned it once or twice. I'm a big fan of your work. So yeah, get cool. That done. Believe in yourself. It's also like, guitaring doesn't need to be the most technical shit, Like, I love country, I love folk music, I love punk, I love all these things. And like, you're a good storyteller. So you don't necessarily need to be writing these sick tracks,
Yes. No, exactly. It's more just, and there's so many other things, I've been sort of learning Ableton and a very amateur level, but it's fun. It's just fun to play with. So I think it's just hard with yachting now. It's sort of a lot. It's not like a 9-to-5 where you can also then still do music. So I don't really have a plan, but I hope to have the time to sort of just like lock myself away for a while and then make a solo thing. And then that'll feel like quite a big accomplishment for me. So I hope to do that, but we'll see. No promises.
I'm obviously looking forward to that.
Cool.
But cool. Thank you for your time. This has been great. Just getting to catch up again. Cause it's been a minute. The last time I might have seen it was like Mealy Pop. So yeah.
No way. It's been years, and a very happy birthday to you tomorrow. Don't be scared. Everything's going to be okay. We're all in this.
Yeah, that's what I'm scared of.
All right. Well, I hope you have a therapist you can talk to that about.
We'll get there.
Awesome, my friend. So lovely to catch up.
So that was Angela. And yeah, man, it really was truly lovely to get to catch up with her, because it's been a few years since we've hung out, and it's always been fun, man. Like I absolutely love Angie's vocals, but also just think she's a wonderful person, and every time we've ever spent time together, it's been a good time. Like, it's just been fun. It's just been no worries, bro. So yeah, this was such a dope chat, and we actually had a great chat afterwards that I wish we had kind of recorded, but I know maybe she wouldn't have wanted some of all of it to come out, and I'm not going to tell you like the specifics, but we were just talking about the whole thing of being in your 30s, having pursued a creative career and having had stuff go well for a while, but then as time goes on, as industries have changed, as everything, like we mentioned, the way the media used to work versus how it does now, it's made things very difficult in a lot of different ways. And so yeah, we were just chatting about that, man, just the whole struggle of being financially stable in your 30s in a creative career, which once again I guess is why she went and worked on the yachts, and that's been it's been helping, but also creates a little bit of a difficulty when it comes to pursuing your creative pursuits. So yeah, man, that, like I say, that was a really fun chat. Like, I found so much of it relatable, because as I'm sure you are aware, if you've been listening to these what's the end of this shit called, I can't remember right now, but these little sections that I talk, that yeah, like, financially things are a bit of a struggle. Like, shit hasn't necessarily been going as smoothly as it could be. And with, like, that's the thing, and being writing at the moment is just fucking pointless, man. It's so fucking pointless, because there's like nowhere to get published anymore, and all the copywriting and that nonsense is being done by AI and shit. So there's like no space for real writing to get published, and all the bullshit writing that I used to do, because yeah, I consider copywriting to just be fucking mindless, dumb, fucking irrelevant nonsense 90% of the time, but hey, it's paid some bills, so I do it. But yeah, even that work has dried up quite a lot. So, you know, I've been trying to pivot and shit. I've been fucking learning things. I've been trying to trying to see where I can fit in somewhere else, but without much success for a while now. But yeah, the other option that that I'm looking at is just the film side of things with the Not Quite Right crew. And that, we do have a few scripts that we want to get made, and so we're going to be applying for funding and those sorts of things. And hey man, hopefully that's an avenue that might work out. But even that, I know, is, it's a long shot, man. Everything these days seems to be a fucking long shot when it comes to, yeah, being financially secure. But whatever, man. I guess that kind of stuff is why, like, on Wednesday. And also just because, you know, a lot of stuff has changed in my life over the last few years, especially obviously since COVID and the stuff with my grand and grandfather. I'm not going to get into all of it now, but if you've been listening for a while, you kind of know the deal. And so, yeah, I woke up not exactly like in the best headspace, but I'm really grateful because a lot of people were just fucking lovely, man. Got a lot of lovely messages from people who I love and respect, and then also a lot of strangers on Facebook. You just go, happy birthday, happy birthday. Like, I don't know, like, do people wake up every day and look at like the birthday things on Facebook and just wish everyone? Because I don't even know who some of those people were, but thank you, I guess. Like, I'm kind of the opinion that if you don't have someone's phone number, then you probably don't need to wish them happy birthday. But yeah, man, like I said, my girlfriend, she made me feel incredibly special. Her gift giving is next fucking level. I'm worried for her birthday now. I'm like, shit, at least I've got like quite a few months, but I'm going to have to step my fucking game up, because she over-delivered and just really made me feel special. And yeah, I guess, as I said, like, I woke up and I wasn't feeling very special at all. And yeah, getting to spend time with her all day, and getting to spend time with the Not Quite Right crew and quite a few of the comedians and quite a few of the crowd. Like, they came out and partied with us afterwards, which was pretty dope. And I mean, it was kind of interesting because most of the people who were at the show had no clue who I was. They just saw the post online and they came through and they seemed to have a good time. But that was, like, I wasn't expecting that, you know. I was expecting to just get up there to a crew of people who I already knew, to a lot of friendly faces. And the faces were friendly, they just weren't familiar. We ended up having a great time, although, yeah, I will admit that it did bum me out a little bit that there weren't more familiar faces in the crowd. But you know what they say, your friends aren't your fans. And that is especially true for my friends. Anyway, that brings us to the shoutouts. Every week at the end of the podcast, go shoutouts to the titular titles tier over at patreon.com. It's a $10 tier, it's a top tier, etc., etc. Anyway, shoutouts to Rousseau, the storage clerk of subtle heresies in the lesser Overberg region. Russell Grant, the Far East correspondent. Neil Green, the key grip. Karan Chetty, the assistant to the regional manager. Kath Jenkin, the inevitable ruler of the universe and Queen Swifty, and Stephen Olivier, the executive producer. Big thank you to Damien Root for the bed music and the banging intro you hear each and every single week. And lastly, shoutouts to you. I will catch you on the flip side.